than they are about transport or eating meat and other factors that typically used to be very high on the concern list. So we want something that is very energy efficient. And that's also useful for stuff that you might want to put in space or in medical devices. And we also want fast imprints, again, for HEP, for stuff on edge, in space, self-driving cars, list this long. And then in high-energy physics, I'm sure you all know, machine learning has increased quite a lot. I made a little plot of a scraped the HEP Living Review of Machine Learning, which is just a web page that collates all of the machine learning papers that are published in HEP. And I made a little plot of the number of papers on there year by year. This plot was made at the end of kind of autumn 25, so the last bar is kind of not complete yet. But I mean, you can clearly see, unsurprisingly, number of machine learning papers in the field is growing quite quickly. And then the triggers, we really care about fast inference. We already do machine learning on FPGAs in many of the experiments, but the need for it seems to be increasing. So I've put a little poll here. You should be able to scan this QR code with your phone to answer the poll. You don't have to sign in, you can just click skip and answer the poll. So the question, and this should obviously work on Zoom as well, the question is how much of the energy consumption and cost do you think that inference, so just evaluating the model, accounts for in a usual machine learning pipeline? So what I'm basing this on is what kind of NVIDIA, Amazon, like AWS, Google, Facebook, their self-reported figures on what they and their users say that it takes up. Just give it a little bit of time and see what we get. Okay, good. Excellent. So that seems that they win ahead, 30 to 50%. And the correct answer here, but again by correct, I mean what they report in their own papers, is 70 to 90%. 50 to 70 is probably, still kind of correct, especially for certain applications. But most of the time, what the figures that they report in their own papers is 70 to 90%. I certainly didn't know that before looking into this, but it kind of goes to show that inference is actually a lot more important than we think it is, especially with LLMs. I think our impression might be that because they're such huge models, it takes so much resource to train them, and it does. But there's also millions of users, so the inference matters. And that's not only the case for LLMs, but also for other machine learning applications. We find that inference actually takes up both a lot of the time and the energy. So it's an important topic. So how do we do our inference? It depends on the task. And I just wanted to give a quick overview of some of the devices. So the one you'll be most familiar with is CPUs. We actually did, you might have seen my name out in a survey on sending out a survey on machine learning in high energy physics. And we had a survey recently asking how people train their machine learning and how they use their machine learning in HEP. And one of the things we found is that about half of people who use ML in HEP actually use their own CPUs, they use their own laptops for it, as opposed to like a cluster or a GPU or a dedicated device, which is quite high because machine learning is quite taxing on a laptop. So it's absolutely fine for something like a small Bayesian decision tree. A small model will do fine on a CPU. But I do think we found that in HEP we do use maybe CPUs a bit more than we should for machine learning. So the next step up is GPUs. And it used to be a bit hard to program GPUs. These days it's very easy. In packages like PyTorch, it's very easy to convert to a GPU. I think based on our survey, one of the issues we do have is that they are sometimes a bit harder to access. The access to GPUs in the field is not entirely even. You have some universities that have fantastic clusters, and then you have others that have more limited clusters. The GPUs are probably the most used chip for machine learning. And then you have the more specialized ones, like tensor processing units or neural processing units. As far as I know, they're not as much used in HAT. They're a bit more specialized, usually used by Meta, Google. And then we have FPGAs, which is the device we'll talk a lot about today. I'm going to go into a bit more detail, but one of the general ideas is that with FPGAs, you can get really fast inference, but it's a bit tricky because you're much more resource constrained. So how to get your machine learning onto FPGA is a bit non-trivial. And then if you want to go really extreme, there's also ASICs, application-specific integrated circuits. So these are devices that are bespoke. So you design your circuit, you print your circuit. And we have lots of them directly on the detectors, both for Atlas and CMS. And the trend that we're finding is that as our data gets bigger, as our computing needs get bigger, we are drifting kind of from this end here over to this end here. We're looking at the more specialized devices. How can we make things more efficient? How can we make it faster? But in general, the tricky thing as well is that in general, it gets more and more hard to program the further you go down. So that is certainly a trade-off. And another thing to keep in mind that we'll come back to is that no matter which chip we use, no matter how we program it, ultimately it is translated to binary logic. And that is something that we will use later. So just to hone in a little bit on FPGAs, this is just kind of a mock-up of how an FPGA might look. So an FPGA, for those of you who, I know there's a lot of expertise here about FPGAs, but for those of you who don't know, an FPGA is essentially a chip you can where you can reconfigure the physical circuit by programming it. So as I mentioned, it has more of a barrier to entry of programming. So typically you can use there are languages like Verilog or VHDL. They certainly have a barrier to learn. They are a bit more tricky. Another alternative is high-level synthesis, where you write even Python-like code, or but more commonly something like C++ or C#, something like that, and then it translates it into something like VHDL or Verilog. Famously, there's also a tool which is called HLS4ML, which is also a tool developed at CERN, and that takes machine learning models, typically written in Python, and translates it to something that FPGAs can use. So that is also a popular package. And FPGAs, you can have very low latency. They're also one part of the reason is that you can parallelize things very well in them. And they also don't have any caches. So a CPU or a GPU will have a cache. So it will try to, you know, predict what's going to happen next and stuff like that. And there's like different levels of memory. So you have to kind of strategize, or maybe it happens in an operating system, how the memory access is done. FPGAs don't have that. And what that means is that you actually have deterministic latency. So that means that you, if you time something, it's going to be the same every time. It's not going to vary depending on how things were in your cache, because there is no cache. And that is a really nice thing. If you need something that can really depend on, for instance, in space, where you need to know that the result is going to come at a certain time, or in medical fields, this can be a very nice thing. And there's also radiation tolerant parts of this, for instance, like we have in atom detectors, for instance. So one thing we do need to understand a little bit to kind of get a foundation for where we're going to go next with this are some of the fundamental building blocks of an FPGA. So usually with if you want to do machine learning on an FPGA, you use what are called DSPs, digital signal processors. They are kind of general arithmetic units on the FPGA. So you can do multiplications, additions, and so on. And usually when you have a neural net, you have a lot of additions and multiplications, and that will be put in this sort of structure. They are quite limited on an FPGA. So it's not uncommon that if you have a machine learning method, you kind of have to make your neural nets a little bit smaller so that it fits into these computing units on an FPGA. Another part of an FPGA is a lookup table. And that's going to be quite important for some of the methods we're going to talk about. A lookup table is exactly how it sounds. It's just a table of inputs and outputs. So typically, on an FPGA, it will look something like this. You usually have 4 to 6 inputs and an output. The advantage of these is that you're just looking something up. So there's no computation per se. And that means that you can get really fast results this way. So it takes just one kind of tick of the clock, computing-wise, to get your answer. You also typically have a lot more of these than you do of the DSPs. And that's going to become important when we talk about different types of neural nets you can do with logic nets. So yeah, here's a more detailed example if you want to see kind of how the computation works, but I don't think it's too important, so let's get through that. As I mentioned, it is sometimes tricky to try and fit a neural net onto an FPGA. So there are lots of techniques to try and do that. And these techniques are used not only for that, but also for making our machine learning faster or more power efficient. So these are some of the, there's lots of techniques out there, but these are maybe the three main ones for taking a big model and making it smaller, making it faster, making it more efficient. The first one is pruning. In pruning, essentially, you just iteratively try to remove stuff in your neural net. You try to remove nodes, you try to remove connections, and you see you just don't get the same accuracy. And you can even do this while you're training, if you want to. And that typically can reduce lots of parameters. Part of that comes from something in machine learning that's called old parameterization. Usually, our models are bigger than we technically would need them to be. But discovering the smallest architecture possible that has the accuracy we need is hard. Therefore, usually we make them bigger than we need to, and we're fine with that. But when we're talking about really quick machine learning, we're not fine with that. That's one method. Another one, especially relevant for FPGAs, is quantization. So typically in a regular neural net, you have, you know, lots of decimal points, you have high bit precision. But very often, you can reduce that and still get away with a pretty good accuracy. So it's essentially just rounding the numbers to make it smaller in memory. And that is especially relevant for FPGAs, where you have limited resources. Again, that's something you can do while you're training so that you can learn the best representation. You can even do it differently in different layers of your neural nets to figure out which parts do I need to be really accurate and which ones do I not. And then there's another method called knowledge distillation. And here you have a teacher model and a student model. And the teacher model is usually a very big neural net. And then the student model is usually quite small. And it just tries to learn the behavior of the bigger model. So it just learns to imitate it, essentially. And this is something that is used for anomaly detection, currently deployed in the CMS level 1 trigger, because we have a big, kind of CNN model, so a convolutional neural net that learns to find anomalies in the data, but it's not small enough to fit on an FPGA. So we have a student model that is smaller that knows how kind of learns how to imitate the teacher. So these are some of the main methods, but they're not really enough. And first of all, it's a bit, as you can kind of see here, it's a bit, as many things in machine learning, it's a bit wishy-washy. It's kind of you try, you fail, you try again. It's quite iterative. It's not very satisfying mathematically. And also there's several theoretical results showing kind of the limits of these methods. And one of the reasons for that is that you're kind of starting big and you're trying to reduce it. You're not going for something small and building up. And there is a fundamental difference in those two strategies. And another thing is that the hardware here usually is almost secondary. We make a good machine learning model and then we say, okay, does this fit on our hardware? Instead of saying, this is our hardware, what machine learning should we do? So we could, perhaps there is some potential for improvement there. So there are some paradigm shifts that aim to kind of shift how we think about machine learning in this way. A few of them would be neuromorphic computing, which is where we try to kind of have machine learning or just computing that mimics how the brain works. So here you can even go as far as having artificial tissue that tries to replicate computations. And one of the reasons that is so appealing is that if you look at the power needed for computations in our brain, it is so low. Like you can't beat evolution that way. So that is a very attractive idea. But as is similar with quantum computing, they're quite not entirely new fields. There has been research for a long time, but we're still quite far away from having scaled machine learning on these things. So though they're very interesting fields, we are a while away. And just to even more convince you that that scaling inference is really important, here is a little plot I made. I analyzed abstracts from Neurips and ICML, which are the two biggest machine learning conferences, and we looked for keywords that mention either like scaling up, so making a model bigger, or inference. And you can see that scaling is becoming sorry, inference, so fast inference is becoming more important, but scaling is the main topic, and the reason for that is kind of as you can see, it's the LLMs, it's the large language models. So people are really focusing on how do we make it bigger, how do we make it more accurate, and then we're kind of forgetting, okay, how do we make it more efficient and quick? So we've seen fast inferences, the needs are increasing, and we aren't quite getting where we need to with the methods we have. And we need it more than ever. So what do we do? Well, one potential solution is logic gate neural networks. I have a very intense slide coming up. So I hope you don't get scared. I just wanted to have this as an overview here, and don't worry if this is kind of a lot in one. But there are links to all of these papers if you are interested in learning about this field. So just wanted to give a bit of a background of how this works in general. And the field of logic, sometimes I say logic gate neural nets, sometimes I say logic neural nets. Sorry about that. It's kind of a nomenclature that's changed within the field recently. I mean the same thing. It has had two kind of main streams. So one is to learn without weights. So in a normal neural net, you have neurons and you have connections. And the thing that you learn is how much each connection matters. So you have a weight that you keep changing as you're learning. And then some people thought, okay, that's really annoying. Maybe we can just learn without the weights. And one really cool way of doing that is that you can actually just map, map your inputs to your outputs directly. So the first way of doing that was like back in the 60s. And you still train in the sense that you have lots of examples and you learn how to map your inputs to a certain output in your memory. And then when you get a new example that looks a little bit different, you know already that it's pretty similar to this mapping you've already created. So you can use that for your output. So actually, that was some of the first vision, like real-time vision image recognition was with this sort of approach. And that was this paper over here. And was with actually like multi-class classification. So similar to some of you might have heard of the MNIST data set, which is like handwritten digits. It's that sort of thing. You take an image and you can classify and say, okay, this is a one, this is a two, or something like that. And that was actually something that we had way back then. It wasn't as good or as accurate as what we have now. The idea is pretty good. And then things didn't maybe change there for a long time. And then in 2022, they came up with several clever tricks to make this kind of adaptable to machine learning in the modern day. And then at the same time, there has been another idea in the field, and that is quantized learning. So again, coming back to the idea of these weights, they are pretty annoying, they take up a lot of memory, they take up a lot of time to learn. So in 2016, there was a very interesting paper on binary neural nets. And here you change your weight so that they're just zero and ones. So essentially what you're learning is almost like connections between modes. And we might think you're going to lose a lot of information that way if you just put it to someone. And you do a little bit. You do have to compensate with other things in your network, like the architecture. But interestingly, you can still learn that way. And then there were some other developments for that. So they recognized that, okay, maybe, so there was like a specific gate they used here. We'll go into the details of that, but then, yeah, some of the developments were, okay, we can use logic gates as well. So instead of just what this stream was doing up here was kind of just mapping. Whoop, a bit late. So this stream up here was kind of just, so their weight is learning was kind of just mapping an input to an output. And then over here, they kind of realized, okay, we can have logic gates as well. And then we can have mapped logic. So you can still use lookup tables, you can still map an output to an input, but maybe you could even implement logic gates in your lookup tables. And that brings us to one of the more exciting developments, which was in 2022, which really kick-started a lot of the developments in this field. So as you can see, it's been going on for a few years before, but this was one of the things that really made it quite relevant again. So again, yeah, there's a link here to that paper. So this was presented at NeurIPS, which is again the biggest machine learning conference. And this is the method that we'll talk through in a bit more detail. Of how we can use logic gates for this computing. There's also some other developments that I won't go into details and some new developments, but there's all links to here for that if you're interested. Yeah, and again, more details just so you can see kind of why there are so many different flavors and which kind of correction each of them brought, because it is very much a developing field. So, what I want to talk about is logic gate neural networks specifically. And I think it's best to show how these work visually. So here's an animation, it's not mine. If you have an image, you can convert it to binary numbers, and then you send it through a circuit of logic gates. At the end, you can accumulate the results in order to get your classification. So it's, at this point, it's kind of similar to a regular neural net, apart from the fact that you have logic bits and you have to binarize your inputs. And this is really, really fast. First of all, because you're using binary numbers. Secondly, you have logic gates, and that means that your compiler can actually simplify it. Even if you say, okay, I need, 1,000 logic gates, the compiler might say, okay, I can simplify that logic. And we can make it smaller. And there's no matrix multiplications. And that is what usually takes a lot of time. Matrix multiplications are, they take a lot of time, whereas here, you just kind of pass it through the network. Now, a challenge is that logic gates aren't differentiable because they are binary. And usually in machine learning, we need to be able to differentiate. And the reason for that is that that's how we know kind of how to update a model. So in each iteration, when you do machine learning, you kind of try some parameters and then you learn where should I go next. You measure how much was I wrong or right, and then you try to update your parameters better next time. If you don't have something differentiable, usually you can't really know what parameters should I try next. So there is a clever little trick in here to make binary logic differentiable. So we actually approximate the logic gates with some regular continuous maths that we can differentiate. And that leads to some weird things. Again, I'm going to show you more visually, so I think that is best. So for each node in the neural net, we actually use continuous numbers while we train. So key difference here is that training and inference looks very different. But during training, what we have is that each node contains 16 different logic gates. And during training, we try to learn which logic gate to use at each node. So as we train, you can kind of see we shift and we see which logic each of our use hit. And then at inference, we choose the best one. So you have this really weird effect that during training, you have 16 different logic gates for each node. During inference, you just select the best one. So your training and your inference looks very different. But then for inference, you have a somewhat small neural net that just contains logic gates. So no matrix multiplications, and that makes it really fast. It has also been extended to convolutional neural nets. I won't go too much into the details there, just because of time, but essentially you retain the idea of a convolution as you do in machine learning, and there's just a couple of tricks to work with logic. Yeah, but I won't go into too much detail there. So the really cool thing about this is when this first came out, it had really, really good results. So on a specific data set, the MNIST data set that I mentioned, handwritten digits, they had the quickest inference of anyone. So they really had an inference that was unparalleled with the accuracy that they also had. So they showed they were able to do this really, really fast. And there's two main papers, and the links are in the slides here, so you can have a look if you want to. And then there's been some developments since then. Again, I won't go into too much details. There are some issues, like training is pretty slow because you have to evaluate these 16 different logic gates at each point, and some other issues, but there is a lot of active research. Another thing to know is that there are actually also several startups in this area. So this guy who wrote this NURBS paper, it's called Felix Peterson, he has a startup. He's a friend of mine. We do talk to him a lot, but he's a bit secretive about his startups, so we're not quite sure where his research is at. But yeah, he has a startup with around, I think, 11 employees, and there's also several other startups in this area, because fast inference is something that many, many companies need. Another really cool thing about using logic gates is that potentially the more verifiable and the more interpretable, the neural components. Because in normal neural nets, you have continuous inputs, continuous outputs. Right? So essentially you more or less have an infinite state space. So if you try to evaluate, you know, how a model will respond to something, that can be really hard. Really, really hard. And either you try to solve it completely and kind of look at all the possible things that can happen, but that takes a lot of compute resource. And for the big models, it's also actually not possible with the methods we have. Or you try to make approximations, which, you know, it can work, but it could also, especially with LLMs, safety is a big concern. So that is hard. With LLMs, you have binary numbers as inputs and as outputs. That means, and you also have logic gates in that, so that means you actually have a finite state space. And that means you can actually just evaluate, okay, what would happen if I pass these values in, what would I get out? Because you have a finite state space. And you don't have to even evaluate all the possibilities. There are ways to simplify it. It's not trivial, it still takes a bit of compute to do, and it might not scale up hugely well. There is one paper on this, but it is something that is very attractive, especially for physics. There might be some very good potential here. Just to kind of hammer down on the point of how much we don't understand and we can't evaluate how the big models work at the moment, I have two polls I'm going to use for this one. So they found that there's lots of different prompt inputs that improves LLM performance. So if you want, please answer the poll right now. So which of these prompting tricks do you think improves LLM performance? So if you're talking to an LLM and it doesn't give you the answer it wants, what can you say to it to make it do what you want? Do you think any of these will work? Thank you. Okay, good. Nice. So you're all kind of right. So the answer is all of the above. All of these things work. And in a way, it shouldn't try. And there's also lots of other weird things about this. Like, and there's other thought we won't do this, but they've also found that in December, if ChatGPT gives you shorter responses as compared to me. Why? And actually, at Anthropic, so the people who have the model Claude, they actually even have a team that is dedicated to looking at the mood of the models. It sounds a bit insane. It sounds a bit insane. And it sounds like we're really anthropomorphizing it. But what happens is drift. So a model can kind of change behavior over time as you're talking to it. And because we can't evaluate the model, we can't just map all the inputs and all the outputs because that probability space is almost infinite. Therefore, we have these teams that just sit there and try to talk to it and try to see what happens. But mathematically, we can't quantify it, we can't predict it that way that we would like to. And obviously, that is kind of why some people don't always like machine learning in physics, because that is kind of uncomfortable if we can't understand the behavior. And logic gates, you know, it's again, it's not trivial, but they do open a door to doing mathematical proofs in the machine learning to show exactly why it has made the decisions it has. So we've shown that, okay, logic gate neural nets, they can do stuff fast. There might be more explainability in it. And it's quite appealing in the sense that instead of just learning a surrogate and then trying to map it to hardware, you're starting by thinking of your hardware and going from there, which is one of the reasons you have it so fast. So I'll just very quickly go through some of the results we saw when we tried this for the cicada data. So in CMS, we have a colorimeter, and from that we make kind of plots of the everything deposits in the colorimeter. It's quite a small image, which is one of the reasons this works. And then there's an autoencoder that learns to reconstruct an image. And then based on how well it reconstructs the image, we know whether this is something it's used to seeing or it's something it's not used to seeing. And from that, you can trigger and say, okay, the model has a really high reconstruction loss, it's not used to seeing this, therefore it's an anomaly. So that is something that is implemented on the trigger, and therefore it's the level one trigger, so it has a very short latency. And we try to then take this model and implement it. So again, as I mentioned, this is kind of a teacher-student situation. So we took the student model, the small model that is implemented on a trigger, and we tried to use the differentiable logic gate neural net method with that. So I'll just go through the results somewhat quickly. Essentially, the most important plot is probably this one. So this is our model. And this in yellow is what is implemented on the tree. And we saw that we actually do get a better accuracy than the baseline model because the baseline model has a lot of tricks, right? It has the quantization, it has the pruning, those kind of standard methods of making a model smaller. So we actually saw that with this sort of method, we can achieve a very good accuracy. And maybe more importantly, we can achieve a very good latency. So there's lots of different flavors of that model that they've tried. The one at the bottom here is our model and our latencies in clock cycles. So that's just kind of how many clock cycles it takes. We do see that we actually have a very, very quick model compared to what is currently there. So there are still some issues to be figured out. But there is promising evidence that we can have both higher accuracy and a lower latency. And when we can have lower latency, it opens up the door to have more complex models that can have better physics accuracy. Because very often we have to kind of do a trade-off of, okay, we need it to be this fast, therefore we have to be okay with losing a bit of accuracy. And maybe this can open up for having better accuracy. So our work so far, one of the main things we are doing is, as I mentioned, the main guy who develops this, he has a startup, so he's a bit secretive. Some of his code is public, We took that and we've continued to develop it with new models and more support. So that library is open. So if you want to try it, you can click that link and play with it and try it out. We've also published a couple of papers on this with a few, maybe not very interesting, it's a bit technical. And we are continuously submitting papers and continuing to develop this. I think there could be a lot of potential applications for this in high energy physics. Triggering, obviously, is a very interesting one. Could it even be something that is relevant for FCC? With really big data, again, we do need good latency. Maybe even it could be used for fast inference offline. You do actually have good performance on GPU for this sort of model as well. So that could be relevant. And again, really appealing thing is that it had opened up for more verifiability in machine learning. Now, just to kind of show some of the challenges in the field, if we compare normal neural nets and logic neural nets, we are kind of in 2008 compared to this. Where we're at with our models, how well they perform, is how well we did with normal neural nets in 2008. And we're finding that scaling these models up is quite tricky. They take a long time to train, and also there are some gradient issues and other issues still to overcome. But it is an active field of research. But right now, yeah, it's good to be aware that there is a limit to how big these models so far has gotten and still see success. So just to summarize, yeah, we just discussed this. But essentially, these models are fast. There's no matrix modifications, potential verifiability. But they can be a bit harder to train. And the threshold to using them is definitely higher than with normal Pythonic machine learning. So to finish up, if you would ever consider using these, feel free to answer the poll. Good. That means the talk has been effective. Okay, thank you. No, but in all seriousness, if you want to get started on this, there is a really good overview paper that talks about all the different flavors of the models that I talked about now. And also, I know some of this is quite complex, so it can take a bit of time to dig in. I'd recommend that paper and the Gidde Peterson papers that are. Also, as I said, the code is open, so have a play around with the code. And then, I'll be around for lunch, or go to me if you want, and ask questions now. And you can also feel free to email me. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from room?
We've had thanks for the next talk. So what you showed was using which gates were the outputs for classification. Can you also do it for, say, regressions?
Yes, yeah, exactly. The only difference is how you kind of sum it at the end. So usually you kind of just group some neurons together, and for classification, you can just look at the binary outputs. And then for regression, you kind of just scale the outputs to get a regressive value.
One question about the is it logic gate neural network where you mentioned this training and inference, and I wonder where does the training happen? And if the training is also happening in the FPGA or is the training happening in the GPU or somewhere, and then after that you sort of convert into the FPGA. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. I understand.
This was all completely new to me, and thank you very much for the talk. In my head, there's some internal sort of debate whether actually a node or with 16 logic gates can also just be represented by a neural network, and actually, at some level, they become the same. Or if this is so, is this a repackaging of something at the very top level? It is the same.
Okay, so
Or
if I understand your question correctly, so yes, you can take a normal neural net and translate it into logic gates. Is that kind of what you were thinking?
So if you infinitely expanded, say what you've got on the board there, within each node you've got, well, at some point you showed 16 logic gates within one node, and thinking surely you could have a neural network with the right weights that represents that exact same behavior.
Yes. Yeah.
If that makes any sense. I don't know if there's a mathematical equivalent, but a different representation going on here.
Yeah. So you absolutely can. And kind of the trick, because it's easy to train the neural net with like continuous weights, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the trick is kind of going to the binary numbers.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
You could just translate a normal neural net into logic gates. Mm-hmm. And that actually was a really active field of research in like the 2000s. Mm-hmm. They found you can't just map it one-to-one into logic gate very easily.
Okay.
And you end up losing a lot of information. So actually there is a lot of research, because that was what I thought as well when I first came to the field. I was like, okay, just and also that means you wouldn't have to retrain. You could just translate what you already had. Yeah, exactly. It was dead easy. But research-wise, it looked to be a dead end.
Okay.
Which is why training in scratch seemed to work better. But yeah,
thank you. Question. Yeah, if you go back to the slide on scalar.
Yeah.
So it looks like you showed on the other slide as well that you get better results with this LGN. And then if you go back to the resource table, then it looks like the resource usage is lower.
Mm-hmm.
Did you try implementing a larger LGN so that would then give you even better results?
Yeah, not so far. So one of the reasons is that the results here are a normal neural net that you see results for here. Our next step was to synthesize in this method, and that was a bit more tricky to fit into the chip. So that is something we're still working on.
But in what way was it tricky to fit into the chip? It was increased resource usage compared with the LGN numbers here.
Yes, it was the synthesis that was the issue.
Because normally, well, for this particular application in particular, it's basically you have certain resources in the chip, then you also have to meet timing in the chip. So I'm wondering if there are problems with meeting timing to
I didn't do the synthesis, but yeah, so I don't know, but yeah, good question. But we are continuing to work on that and trying to the ultimate to use the same.
In my incredibly limited experience, quantization seems to be a huge problem. And I don't know if you have any tricks to deal with it or if it's more or less just trial and error.
Mm. So the nice thing about this is that quantization has already happened. Because when you do your inference, you're only operating binary numbers. Like you translate your input to binary. So it's already completely binary, so you don't have to worry about quantization anymore. Same with pruning. It's kind of built into the architecture of this. So whereas with normal neurons, as you say, it's a big problem with quantization and pruning. It's really messy. Here, it comes baked in from the start.
Continue on into my question. One thing I was looking at, regards to this, is are you limited by the designs of FPGAs in the three example lookup tables that only take maybe 6 or 8 inputs to a lookup table? So that limits you. So, for example, in a standard machine learning, the way you get around it, you could have a layer of 100 nodes and an input could go to one input going to the 107 nodes, or vice versa, one input taking. 1,000 inputs, but you can't do that on FPGA because the logic gates. Like, is that a problem you find? Or
So absolutely, I think that is a problem. I think that, and it will be more of a problem in the future. I think right now the limiting factor on the FPGAs themselves is the fact that if you try to scale this up to something big, you lose gradients. So there's like gradient issues in the machine learning that people are really trying to solve. But I think that will be. And also another issue is that usually in machine learning, as you go deep, you sometimes have to add like residual layers. And it's not entirely obvious how that would be in logic gates. So it's kind of that is the issue, but I think you're absolutely right. Once that is solved, then the resource utilization on the FPGA will probably be the limiting factor.
Okay. So
completely naive with machine learning, so this might be a silly question. But so when you've got these 16 gates, and you kind of, the example you gave, there was one that kind of on the weighting became very obvious, and it was that one that was chosen. I mean, I can imagine that there are cases where, you know, two are very similar weights within those 16. Is that then, is there then an option to iteratively do this, where you then say, okay, that one logic gate, I got to, I can split it, add a third gate to recombine, kind of thing. Is there kind of an iterative, you know, kind of build the logic gates, more complexity into it as you go?
That's a really neat idea. As far as I know, no one has tried that in the field yet. I mean, it is a very insightful question, because that is one of the reasons why the gradients disappears, because some of the logic gates almost like cancel out, and some of them do have very similar signals. I think, yeah, as far as I know, no one has tried to kind of like figure it out that way by adding logic gates. That's a neat idea. Yeah, maybe that would work.
Okay. Just coming to your page where you talked about where this was in the sort of timeline compared to other things, and you 2008. What are the, it was another page where you had the so what sort of criteria are you using in order to say, oh, it's like 2008 in the comparison?
Just accuracy on standard data sets.
Okay, but that's, so you mean like these numerals? That...
Yeah, so there are many, that data set, and then there are many other like it that are usually used as benchmarks. And have been useful as benchmarks for a long time. And just based on the accuracy it achieves on that, then it is kind of around 2005.
Okay. So that's sort of the biggest network we can achieve with implement at the moment, and that's the...
Thank you for the nice talk. So I was a bit curious about how difficult it is to train like this compared to conventional models, because it does seem that once you do train it, it has like lower number of parameters, lower latency, higher efficiency due to using FPGAs. But is the training like actually like harder, or is it actually similar?
Yeah, very good question. Yeah, your intuition there is right. It is. It is absolutely harder to train. So on these kind of typical benchmarks, very often you can train and get really good accuracy in like a few minutes. These logic gate neural nets might take an hour. They are harder to train, both in the code you have to write, in how sensitive they are to the parameters you use, so you might have to iterate more, and also just in pure training time. They are definitely harder.
Yeah, you mentioned that you don't have the problem with quantization here, but then you have in some sense a similar one in these cases, like Craig mentioned, where when the training is going on, maybe the confusion is that you have, you know, you want to, when you've got this combination of 16 logic gates, you have two of them which seem very promising, because that's giving a 50-50 contribution.
Yes.
How's that? Is there something in the training which... at the moment at least kind of forces the training to prefer a single output?
Yes. Yeah, very good question. So the thing that forces it to prefer something is a softmax function.
Okay.
So it just kind of push it to do that. But then you're also right, there is something that we call a discretization gap. You are definitely right that once you go from that training and having continuous weights to having binary weights, you do lose performance. So there is definitely something lost there. There is a paper on it on trying to reduce that. One of the things that people have found is that if you inject it, it can actually help with that and make it, you know, further out gates instead of just evening out. So typically when you train, you see something like this, where there's a gap between your training and inference. And yeah, there are a few tricks to mitigate it. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
Let's take a question from Zoom. David, please unmute and go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, the other obvious game in town for look-based inference is boosted decision trees, you know, which give you a lot of the, you have the explainability, you've got the No, you can do the differentiability at some level. So, I mean, where you're ending up seems very close to that. Do you care to comment how you're
Yes.
different from the sort of BDT route with sort of, Conifer rather than HLS for ML and that sort of game?
Absolutely. So there is, you're absolutely right that you could do this with visualization trees, and there is a paper called TreeLUT that is linked here that came out last year, that covers exactly that. And they do get very good performance. The way the computations are done are different. Kind of the structure of having the way the nodes work is a little bit different. And you can read the paper if you're interested. But yeah, they are the way they're trained, the architectures do end up being slightly different. But yeah, you're absolutely right. There is definitely similarity there.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Any other question from Zoom? Looks like not. So let's thank our speaker for the question as well as the topic.
Thank you. That was excellent. That was fantastic.
Where is the I'm sorry, yes. You too. How did you